From Tennessee to Washington, Colorado to Vermont, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, rooftop solar panels sound like a great way to save on your electric bill and be environmentally friendly. But David Williams of the Taxpayer Protection Alliance says homeowners are losing out financially to big solar companies. He joins us to explain. Kansas has unexpectedly become home to the hottest U.S. Senate race in the country. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on why the Sunflower State is so competitive. A rally against so-called climate change was recently held in New York City. Eric Boehm talks with Matt Kittle for a Watchdog Radio look at what the global warming activists didn't tell you. And President Obama has unleashed air attacks on ISIS in both Syria and Iraq. But on his American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says the bombing campaign is too little, too late, and the wrong strategy. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Whether or not climate change is actually real, alternative energy sources are sometimes financially advantageous. Rooftop solar panels are gaining in popularity, but unfortunately, big, politically connected solar panel firms, rather than homeowners, are the ones who are profiting. David Williams is president of the Taxpayer Protection Alliance. He has looked into the situation and joins us now to talk about it. Dave, welcome to American Radio Journal. Dave, when we talk about the solar investment tax credit, could you give us a little background on it? What does this tax credit provide?
This tax credit was set up in 2005 to give a 30% tax credit on the purchase of solar panels, and really for households that buy solar panels and put them on top of their houses. And the purpose of it was to give this tax credit to really encourage people to buy more solar panels and to use more solar energy.
That would sound to be a fairly ambitious and positive goal. Obviously, if we could use solar energy more, that would be a good thing. Have homeowners found this to be of benefit to them?
Homeowners have gotten a bit of a shock because when they've put these solar panels on top of their houses and they sign the paperwork, they are actually leasing the panels. So the homeowners aren't the ones who are getting the tax credit. It's the companies that are leasing the panels. They retain ownership of the panels, so they're the ones who are getting the tax credit. And that's really been the biggest shock for the homeowner because they thought they were going to get the tax credit from the federal government and, in certain cases, state governments. But it's really the companies that are retaining all this money.
As a consumer, do I have the option, Dave, of doing an outright purchase, or are all the solar companies doing leasing?
All the solar companies are doing leasing because it really is cost prohibitive to buy these panels. We've seen some homeowners who have tried to buy them, but as I mentioned, it is cost prohibitive, and these leases really make economic sense from one standpoint for the homeowner because they don't have to buy them, but really the repercussions of the lease go well beyond just the lease payments, but also trying to resell their house. And there's really just a whole host of problems with leasing the panels.
So as a homeowner, if I were to go out and lease one of these rooftop solar systems, I would get no benefit at all on my income tax in terms of a tax credit for having done that?
The homeowner would get zero benefit on their income tax from leasing these panels. And that's part of what the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, what we're trying to do is educate folks and close the loophole, because I think if we're able to close the loophole and give the homeowners the tax credit, that would be a step in the right direction, and I think that would stop a lot of these companies from taking advantage of homeowners. But at the end of the day, the homeowners, buyer beware, caveat emptor, they need to be cognizant of what they're getting into before they sign a lease.
Now, I have one of these. Say I bought it, I put it on my house. I would assume that I am going to, as a result of the electrical power that is generated from having these solar panels on my roof, I'm going to have lower electric bills. Does that, in fact, compensate the homeowner enough to make it worthwhile doing?
See, that's where the numbers really become upside down for the homeowner, is that first you're paying for the lease, and that's an out-of-pocket expense for the homeowner. You're paying the lease, a monthly payment to, for the lease. And then you have the devaluation of the house. We have talked to homeowners where their houses houses have been devalued because they have these solar panels on top of the houses, and they don't actually own the panels. I mean, it's almost like having a leased car on top of your roof and then trying to sell your house along with that car. It just it doesn't work. And the money that they're saving on electricity does not compensate for the money that they're losing through the lease or through the devaluation of their home.
Rarely in Washington does something happen by accident. So the fact that these solar companies are the ones who are benefiting, is this a policy by design where certain politically favored companies are getting a tax favor from the federal government?
It's politically favored companies because one of the biggest companies in the market right now is a company called SolarCity, which is owned by Elon Musk, and he has been a contributor to the Obama campaign, to the Democrats. So it's that, but it's also an administration and a Congress who are pushing green and green technology. So I think what happens is the federal government, and in certain cases state governments, look the other way because they want green energy to succeed. And they will do everything in their power, whether it's through policy, whether it's through taxation, or whether it's through ignoring some of the hazards of solar power. They will do that to push this new technology. And homeowners are caught up in it, too. I mean, let's be honest. If you're a homeowner, you want to be part of sort of the new technology, the green technology. But there are still a lot of unanswered questions we have about it.
I would assume, Dave, that if this were actually done right so that homeowners were able to keep the tax credit, homeowners benefited, it might be something that more people would be interested in doing. Is there any movement in Congress toward changing? Is this a law? I guess, first of all, is this a law or a regulation that Congress could, in fact, act on?
I think it's just a huge loophole, and we're actually working in specific states to talk to state legislatures to close the loophole. Now, on the federal level, we have to do the exact same thing, is to make sure that if this tax credit does exist, that it does go to the homeowners. And one of the problems is you have a Congress that just isn't in Washington, D.C. a lot. They're not working a lot. They're more concerned about reelection. They're more concerned about a lot of other things than closing this massive loophole. And the problem is that Congress doesn't think there's a problem. So it's really a case of education, of educating members of Congress that this is a problem. That's why the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, we have reached out to a number of groups. We've reached out to firefighters. We've reached out to minority communities, really to draw more attention to solar panels.
Dave Williams is the president of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. And Dave, tell us a little bit about your organization.
The Taxpayers Protection Alliance, we are a taxpayer watchdog. We try to improve the efficiency of government, you know, make it more transparent, and really provide a voice for people in Congress. Because at times, Congress is really stuck inside the beltway, whether physically or just the mentality. And we really want people to know that the Taxpayers Protection Alliance is here to address all spending issues and really to make government work more efficiently.
You have written a column on rooftop solar companies. So if we have listeners who would like to read that column or learn more about the Taxpayer Protection Alliance, Dave, where can they go to get that information?
We're on the web at protectingtaxpayers.org. There's an email form if they want to get in touch with me about the solar issue or other issues. Be more than happy to chat with folks via email and try to solve some of the problems that we have.
David Williams of the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. Dave, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Andy Roth is at the Club for Growth, where, as usual, he is keeping an eye on United States Senate races in states all across the country. Andy, always a pleasure having you here.
Thanks for having me.
We have been trying to track these U.S. Senate races in particular because control of the United States Senate certainly up for grabs in November's election. Andy, a state that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, and it has gone way up on the list of competitive states, much to many people's surprise, that is your home state of Kansas. Can you give us an update on what's happening there?
It is a bit of a surprise, but if you look at why it's gone away from the Republican Party's direction, it almost doesn't seem like a surprise. When you look back at previous races and previous cycles, like Bob Bennett in Utah, Dick Lugar in Indiana, and even Thad Cochran in Mississippi this election cycle, the one unified theme is that all of those men had become fixtures in Washington. They had just been in D.C. too long. And even though Thad Cochran was able to escape defeat but with the help of Democrats, there was definitely enough displeasure with him that there was a lot of opposition to him. And that's the case with Pat Roberts. He's been in Washington for four decades. He lives in Virginia. Voters in Kansas joke about how Virginia has three senators and Kansas only has one. There was a GOP strategist who even joked that if you look at what Roberts has done over the last four decades, you can't think of anything. So he's really neglected the voters, and I think that's why Kansas voters are retaliating. And his opposition is a guy named Greg Orman, who's an independent, but he's very prolific in fundraising and campaigning, and that's why the Democrat in this race dropped out and is off the ballot. So this is a head-to-head between a Kansas Republican and a Kansas independent. Now, I will say that Orman, the independent, is nothing of the sort. He is a liberal. If the Senate somehow ended in a 50-49 tie with Republicans, with 50 and the Democrats at 49, Orman is Machiavellian enough, at least if you listen to what he says, that he would caucus with the Republicans. But he is a very, very liberal Republican in that sense. But if the Democrats held on control, he would caucus with them. So there seems to be a shortage of principles with this guy, but he may actually win just because people are so sick and tired of Pat Roberts.
So we have this situation now in Kansas where we have a hotly contested race, reminding our listeners that Republicans need to pick a net of six seats in order to gain control of the United States Senate. Andy, there had been a lot of nerves over races in Georgia and Kentucky where they are Republican seats that Republicans are defending. How are those races breaking as we head here into the home stretch?
Kentucky, Georgia, and Kansas are considered the three seats that Republicans most vigorously have to defend. Kansas is clearly the toughest one to defend. Kentucky and Georgia were originally believed to be very competitive, but as we're seeing now, and it could change, the momentum is going with the Republicans. So I suspect that if the elections were held today, Pat Roberts would probably lose, and McConnell and David Perdue, the candidate in Georgia, would probably win. So there would be a net loss for Republicans of one seat. So that means they'd have to pick up seven Democrat seats in order to get the majority.
If we assume that you need seven Republican pickups now, again, assuming that at least one of the three imperiled or one of the three competitive Republican states is a loss, are there six states out there that Republicans realistically have a chance of winning?
There are six, and there could be seven or more. No race is easy, but the Senate races in Montana, South Dakota, and West Virginia are considered the GOP's best chances of picking up Democrat-held seats. So if the election were held today, we would bank those quite easily. Then after that, you've got Arkansas, Alaska, Louisiana. In all three of those races, the Republican challenger is winning. They're polling above the Democrat incumbents. And typically the undecideds break away from the incumbent as you get closer to the election. So those races are looking better and better each day. So right there you've got six. And I think that Republicans will pick those up if the election were held today. After that, it gets a little bit more difficult. You've got races in Colorado, Iowa, North Carolina, New Hampshire, Michigan, Minnesota, and all of those are different to varying degrees. But it's very conceivable that we could pick up one or two of those. And if something goes wrong with the military campaign in Iraq and Syria, or if the new premium hikes in Obamacare, which are set to be released in a few weeks, if those go the wrong way for Democrats, then you could see a GOP wave this election cycle, and things could get much better for Republicans. So cautiously optimistic, but it looks like Republicans are in the driver's seat right now.
Very briefly, New Hampshire is a really interesting race with Scott Brown having moved from Massachusetts. What are the dynamics there at the moment?
Yes, that is one of those seats that isn't currently favoring the Republicans, but it's close enough that we can pick it up. Gene Shaheen, the incumbent, is polling below 50, which is always a troubling sign for an incumbent, but she's just below 50. We're talking like 47, 48, 49. If things break the GOP's way, then Brown could win that.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 100,000 members all across the country from all 50 states, and we're united because we believe in economic liberty. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Election Day coming up in just about 5 weeks, so we will continue to keep an eye on things with Andy Roth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Leaders of the global warming movement gathered in New York City recently in an effort to gin up support for their cause, which has fallen behind the economy, national security, and a wide range of other issues on the public agenda. Eric Boehm talks with Matt Kittle for this Watchdog Radio look at the event. Eric?
Maybe you saw some of the coverage on the news of the climate march and the climate change effort going on in New York this week as the United Nations meets. But there's a story behind the story, and that's what we're going to talk about here today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Watchdog Radio. Joining me is Matt Kittle, my friend and colleague from Wisconsin. He's a national reporter for Watchdog.org. And Matt, you and our Watchdog colleague Bruce Parker covered the People's Climate March in New York this week, covered it pretty extensively. Quite an interesting cast of characters out there. Thanks for being on the show. Tell us a little bit about some of what you saw on the streets of New York.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, as always. I appreciate it. And let me ask you this. I'll start it with a question. Did you get your Climate Change Summit shirt?
I did not. I must have missed the stand for that.
I'll have to get a message into Ban Ki-moon and see if we can get his shirt. It was an interesting... I don't think interesting begins to describe the People's Climate Change March. And our good friend Bruce Parker did a great job of vividly bringing that home, just all of these different folks from the environmental movement. Some people with some serious thoughts to bring to the table. A lot of people, it seemed, that were there to have a party in Manhattan, and that's what this march was on Sunday, basically. A lot of noise, this notion of solidarity. Al Gore was there. Leonardo DiCaprio was there. Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, as we said. All kinds of folks were there. Big celebrities, big stars, lots of activists in the environmental movement. In talking about the concerns of the environment, climate change, and those sorts of things, but really, at this march and then at the summit where President Obama was and leaders from around the world were there, not a lot of conversation about what these sorts of regulations in the United States and these sorts of standards that would be in place, ratcheting up these standards, would mean ultimately for the global economy.
That's right. You've got groups there ranging from the environmentalists to the Socialist Party and outright communists and socialists calling for all sorts of new regulations imposed by the United States, by other coalitions of governments, by the United Nations. I guess you can't get much bigger than that in terms of global regulations and global rules. But I think you touch on a very important point here. There's a story behind the story, and that is that it's not just about what these regulations would mean possibly for the environment. I don't think that, in many cases, they're not even things that we could prove would fix some of the environmental issues that the activists are pointing to, but really serious costs for the global economy. And you looked at that in your story this week on Watchdog.org.
We talk about all of the people who were there, but we don't talk too much about the people who weren't there. And there were some biggies, including China's president and the prime minister of India. These two countries hold the world's largest population. They control a third of the world's population, and they rank number one, China, number three, India, on the list of carbon dioxide emitters. The United States is number two. The United States was there. But if you don't have number one and three there, first of all, what kind of summit do you have? Because here's the bottom line. And this is what a lot of people in the industry, in the fossil fuel industries in particular, coal in particular, were telling me, and the manufacturing side, that if China and India aren't part of this, none of this really matters, because they're going to continue to use the available, readily available resource of coal to continue to produce, to continue to sustain their manufacturing base. Now, if the United States comes in and sets up all of these regulations, we talk about the war on coal and those sorts of things, China doesn't do it, what does that do to our economy? What does that do to our manufacturers who rely on this? It really puts us at a severe disadvantage globally. And for what purpose? Because if the number one and number three polluters aren't coming to the table, aren't coming along for this climate change summit, what is it going to do ultimately for the environment in the end?
Absolutely, because that coal is still going to be coming out of the ground. It's going to get burned, and all the pollution is still going to go in the air. It's just going to get burned in China or India instead of getting burned in the United States. We're talking with Matt Kittle from Watchdog.org about the People's Climate March this past week. Matt, just about a minute left to go here. Time really flies by. But what sort of regulations? We don't expect that this is a lot of sound and fury, probably signifying nothing, at least at the United Nations level, but there's a lot of concern about regulations that the EPA is currently looking at and what that could mean for manufacturing in particular in this country.
Yeah, quickly, there are some proposals on the table, of course, that would shut down new power plants. And these power plants, of course, coal-fired power plants, that really have come a long way in terms of design, in terms of limiting carbon emissions. It will shut down the existing coal plants. And when you do that, it's going to have a pretty stern impact on the economy.
And as you point out in your story, the EPA accounts for more than half of the regulatory cost burden on manufacturers right now. You have to wonder if any of the people at the march in New York this week, whether they might pay attention when things start to cost a lot more, or when their electricity turns off because there just isn't enough left to generate. There isn't enough energy out there to generate to meet the demand in the United States. But Matt Kittle, really.
It's going to hit their cell phones, isn't it? It's going to hit their smartphones and their iPads and everything else, these environmentalists.
You'll have a hard time, charging them up. Matt, we really appreciate your work. As I said, you can read that up at watchdog.org. Matt and our Watchdog colleague, Bruce Parker, really did a great job covering the People's Climate March in New York. Matt, we are out of time, so we've got to run. I'm Eric Baim for Watchdog Radio. Again, check out all our work at watchdog.org, and you can catch us right back here again next week on American Radio Journal.
After waiting too long to confront ISIS, President Obama has ordered a bombing campaign against the terrorist group operating in Syria and Iraq. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA looks at the possibility air power alone can dislodge ISIS on this American Radio Journal commentary.
On Monday night, President Obama announced the beginning of an anti-ISIS bombing campaign. Just prior to this, the YouGov polling firm that tracks presidential approval on foreign policy recorded its second lowest approval number ever, only 36% approval and 56% disapproval. Will this bombing campaign produce the kind of increase in support that we typically see whenever this country begins a major military action? I would suggest that the answer depends on whether one sees this limited military engagement as a better late-than-never effort to address the horrific beheadings and other atrocities being committed by the so-called Islamic State, or just one more step in the continual collapse of the Obama foreign policy. While a short-term bump in approval should be expected, I predict that it won't last, because the Obama foreign policy really is collapsing, and it's collapsing because it has always rested upon fallacious assumptions, attitudes, and wrong actions. I'll outline four of the most egregious. First, he appears to truly believe the naive hypothesis that if we were just nicer to our adversaries, they'd be nicer to us. Second, and similarly, he has embraced the weakening of our military in the unfounded hope that we'd be seen as a friendlier nation by the rest of the world if only we weren't so strong. Third is the Obama administration's willful blindness to the profound and growing threats of jihadism and expansionism and militarism by both Russia and China. And fourth, he has undermined alliances that have endured for generations with countries like Israel, the United Kingdom, and Germany, creating a widening mistrust of America among our friends and the virtual evaporation of fear of military retaliation among our adversaries. At this point, no one in the world can believe the U.S., which means our diplomacy cannot work. Examples of this are his abrogation of the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, a mutual support agreement among Russia, Ukraine, the U.S., and the U.K., and the almost childish rhetorical red line he drew in Syria and then almost immediately ignored its breach and even denied its origins and authorship. Now we're told that he is personally approving bombing targets, bringing back awful memories of President Johnson doing the same thing in Vietnam. I wonder if he's also responsible for the timing decision to bomb buildings used by ISIS leaders at night when they could be expected to be empty. General Michael Hayden, retired Air Force four-star and former head of the Central Intelligence Agency, has said that this new campaign may be less significant than it initially appears. Not only are the specific targets few in number, but also other restrictions imposed on the military by the Obama administration will hamper its effectiveness. And no bombing campaign alone will ever root out indigenous terrorists who can easily melt back into the population from which they came. As the American public catches on to the inherent fecklessness of trying to defeat terrorists from the air, whatever benefit of the doubt they may grant the president in September is likely to bleed away in a month or two, just when the president hoped he'd have it to save a Democratic majority in the United States Senate. Thus, the bombing campaign will almost certainly fail in the Middle East and on Capitol Hill, likely sending President Obama into the weakest lame duck final 2 years of any presidency in recent memory. He'll probably pull back from any further military initiatives and instead undertake a fresh round of domestic radicalism. That won't be good for America. Let's hope that he has to face a newly Republican Senate as well as a Republican House of Representatives. Then he will have to veto bills rather than blame his administration's dysfunction on Congress. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on over 190 public affairs-minded radio stations in 45 states across the country. They include WHJE-FM in Carmel, Indiana, KWTO-AM in Springfield, Missouri, and WBBC-FM in Blackstone, Virginia. If you would like to comment on any of the topics that you've heard discussed here on American Radio Journal, please email us at AmericanRadioJournal@gmail.com. That's AmericanRadioJournal@gmail.com, or visit our page on Facebook. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.